I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Siberia is a vast and forbidding place of extremes, home to the coldest city and the largest forest on Earth, and a lake that holds one-fifth of the planet's fresh water. It's also a place of exile and banishment, where dissidents and prisoners were sent under Tsarist Russia and the Soviet Union. Our guest, Sophie Roberts, spent 2 years traveling Siberia in search of a piano for a young woman who she had met while visiting a friend in Mongolia. Her book, The Lost Pianos of Siberia, is about Siberia's history, about how pianos were hauled by sled and boat centuries ago and created a musical culture amid suffering and survival. She joined us by Skype to talk about what she learned in Siberia, the many people she met, and her work as a travel writer. She used to cover luxury hotels and now writes about some of the remote regions of the world. And Sophie Roberts, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
How can you take in? I'm imagining you flying into Siberia for the first time. How were you able to take in the vastness of this huge expanse of territory?
It was so overwhelming. I had to do what all travelers need to do when they start on any journey, which is with a map. Because Siberia, the place, is ill-defined. It's changed its borders over the centuries. It's been defined differently by the changing regimes. So in order to get my head around it, I had to set my own borders. And I went with Anton Chekhov's description. Anton Chekhov was traveling in the late 19th century. He has a wonderful description about how Siberia begins in Ekaterinburg, which is a city in the Ural Mountains on the western edge. And Siberia ends, and this was the phrase that unleashed the kind of poetry I needed to just explore goodness knows where, which I took to be the far reaches of the Russian Far East. It's a huge area, as you said.
Yes, I'm sort of hard to wrap our imagination around it. I'm wondering about, since it the coldest city on the planet is in Siberia, it is winter now. What is it like to be in such a frigid part of the world?
Well, there was this wonderful moment where I met a lady who lived on the shores of Lake Baikal, which is right in the middle of the Siberia I'm talking about. And I said, oh, golly, this really is brutal. You know, minus 40 and then incredibly hot in summer when the mosquitoes burst out in vast plumes from the melted tundra. It's, you know, as vicious as the Siberian legend suggests that these mosquitoes were born from the ashes of a cannibal. So neither winter nor summer is pleasant. And she said to me, she looked me straight in the eye and she goes, oh, get over it. Just dress properly, which put me right. And I realized that, yes, indeed, Siberia is a wardrobe problem. Dress properly.
And what did you wear? How did you stay warm?
So in winter, you have to work with kind of polar gear, which we're lucky and, you know, modern technology can provide it. In summer, I found that much, much harder because the mosquitoes can literally cut through three layers of clothing, which I had to wear. And even then, I almost had a very bad allergic response. So I also wore netting across my face. I wore gloves. And still they would get me. So I confined my travels to winter when, to be honest, Siberia is also very magical. You know, the snow is, you know, floating, not falling. It's divine. It's like watching diamonds fall and everything's coated in white. It's got the romance that I was first drawn to as a reader of Tolstoy and all the rest. So I loved it in winter, so long as I'd understood that basic rule of dress properly.
Dressing properly. I think there's some phrase like, you know, there's no bad weather, it's just bad clothing. And so the importance of understanding that. What's interesting is you got to Siberia through Mongolia, where you had a friend, and this friend introduced you to a musician, a pianist, a pupil, a protege, who was a truly gifted young player. Tell us about her.
Yes, so I've been going to Mongolia for a while. I work often as a freelance writer for the Financial Times, and I've been coming and going doing stories there. And in one of those on one of those occasions, I'd ended up in a place called the Orkhon Valley, which is in the west of the country, about 8 hours' drive from the capital, Ulaanbaatar. It's a splendid, splendid place. No roads. There's more horses than people. The communities live by herding. They live in these tents called ger, which have sort of felted sides. And on one of these occasions in 2015, I was staying with a friend who's married to a Mongolian lady, and there was a young pianist there who was teaching family and some of the herder children piano through the summer months. And she was playing on a Yamaha grand piano that was in one of these tents. And you can imagine, it's the most perfect acoustics, the felted sides, the sound rolling off the edges and then floating up into the sky, stars above and a river beside. It's just divine. And my friend, who knows more about music than I, leant over to me and said, "Well, this pianist, she deserves a better instrument than that," because the Yamaha had been bashed around by climate and all the rest of it. And he was the person who said to me, "You must go and find her." And he used this phrase, which I found so evocative, "one of the lost pianos of Siberia." And that set me off on a quest and a deepening friendship with Ogdarel Sampilnorov, who's the Mongolian pianist, just a gifted, gifted player. And what fun it was to go searching over just over the border, because of course Mongolia borders Siberia, and starting to dig into this very curious history that Siberia has had with the piano and piano culture.
And we're going to end the show with a clip from one of her performances. Well, let's talk about how pianos came to Siberia. And one can imagine, especially a couple of centuries ago, you know, taking a violin or taking a flute, you can put it in a case and carry it. But the thought of dragging pianos before there were automobiles or trains into this remote and extreme region of the world, I guess we have Catherine the Great to thank for that.
Yeah, Catherine the Great, which is always amuses me, because Catherine the Great claimed to be deaf as a post. She said, "You know, music's just noise to me." And apparently court musicians were assigned to tell her when to clap. But Catherine the Great was a great, she was an Anglophile. You know, she could hire a gardener from Scotland, she would. If she could hire a piano maker from London, she would. And so she did in 1774, ordering this wonderful Zumpei from London, which became one of the first pianos in Russia and survives to this day. And she was surrounded by very influential people who loved music. Her lover, Potemkin, who would send his, you know, courier to Milan to fetch him her sheet music. And then you had her daughter-in-law, Maria Fyodorovna, who traveled to Vienna and heard Clementi and Mozart dueled in 1782. So it was under Catherine the Great that this piano began to enter the lives of Russians. But then, of course, you have the arrival of these virtuosos in the 1840s. And Franz Liszt was the moment, 1842. He was like the Rolling Stone of his time. And there's this incredible description of him playing in St. Petersburg, with sort of women grabbing at strands of his bobbed hair to wear in lockets and fighting over the cherry stones he spat out. So you imagine, this piano mania is taking over Russia, Western Russia, European Russia, the rich and aristocratic life of Petersburg and Moscow. But at the same time, this European Russia is colonizing Siberia. So as they move across the Urals, the governors, the aristocrats, the misfits, the aristocratic exiles who were rich enough to drag one with them, they would bring these instruments that reminded them of their culture from home. And that's where we start to see this seepage of piano culture into Siberia.
And you use the word drag, and in many ways they had to be dragged into Siberia.
Indeed. And I sort of loved the sort of absurdity of that image, which got me so interested in this history in the first place. And there's one relatively well-known story about a woman called Maria Volkonsky, a princess who followed her husband, who was a political dissident, into Siberia, where he was exiled. And she dragged behind her her clavichord, an early piano, and it was strapped onto the back of her sledge. At 3,000 miles, she took this instrument. She kept it with her in the prison cell that she ended up sharing voluntarily with her husband during his period of exile. And there's an incredible description of her crossing Lake Baikal, the frozen Lake Baikal, when with this instrument behind her. And I was just, I suppose I've had enough with the idea of how could somebody care so much about music to make that the single object that goes with her into this distant, cold and miserable place.
You write about what happened under the Soviet Union and Lenin, you know, wanting, I guess, the piano or certainly music to be part of the common folk. How did that expand in Siberia?
Well, what you had is at the end of the 19th century, just prior to the revolution, you have St. Petersburg by this time is Pianopolis. That's what they call it. There's so many pianos. There's descriptions of 100 apartments, of which 93 have an instrument and a piano tuner shared among them. So it was you couldn't make these instruments fast enough. One of the biggest factories was called Becker, one of the biggest Russian factories, and supported by state subsidies, by taxation, etc. etc. And with the revolution, Becker was nationalized. And instead of grand pianos, it became Red October. Becker changed its name to Red October. And it became affordable uprights that were distributed into the far, far reaches of the Soviet Union. It was an instrument for everyone, not just the bourgeois elite. And that is why Siberia has this rather curious, or to me, surprising level of musical education, passion for this instrument and access to the actual technology that was required at the time. And while that's no longer quite the case now, it certainly was right up until that Red October factory closed only in 2004.
In fact, you quote a Siberian pianist who talks about a Siberian audience saying they understand everything. They are my number one audience, that this culture is so rich and so deeply felt.
That's Denis Matsuyev, a really, really brilliant pianist, and he gave me those words, and I started to understand because I'd heard him play at Carnegie Hall in New York, and it's a different audience. You then hear in Siberia, and Siberia, people don't realize this. I didn't realize till I started searching. Siberia has the largest opera house in Russia. It's in the city of Novosibirsk. There are multiple performance spaces in the cities along the Trans-Siberian and further afield. There are these things called houses of culture, which was how the Soviet system distributed culture across the more remote areas. And all of these are performance spaces. And you do encounter, sure, the audiences aren't full, sure, not all the performances are great, but there is a sense of an appreciation for music that perhaps I feel, I'm English, you can hear, I'm here in Britain, that has been lost in our kind of provincial regions, for sure.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break. I want to pick up on that and several other things and also talk about some of the darker sides of Siberia, the fact that many prisoners were sent there, many dissidents were sent there as well. Talking with Sophie Roberts, she's got a new book. It's called The Lost Pianos of Siberia. She is a writer. She's a British writer, as you can tell from her accent, and she does focus on remote travel. And you can join our conversation. Any questions or comments, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Sophie Roberts. She's in England, and she's got a new book called The Lost Pianos of Siberia. I think it was under Tsarist Russia that Siberia was described as a prison without a roof. And I do want to talk about the numbers of people who were sent there, either under Tsarist Russia or under the Soviet Union. Obviously, the misery of these gulags, of these labor camps. How many people died, do we know, under these conditions who were sent to Siberia?
Yeah, I mean, these are really contentious figures, but I've tried to find a middle way in them. And roughly 1801 to 1917, we're talking about 1 million subjects were banished to Siberia under the Tsarist penal exile system. Under the Gulag, the Soviet Gulag labor camp system, 1929 to 53, I went with Anne Applebaum's figures here, about 2.7 million forced laborers died in the Soviet Gulag, remembering that the Gulag was not just Siberia, but there was a very, very high concentration in that region. So just huge numbers, and numbers that one can't even think through those individual lives. And in a way, this piano quest allowed me to zero in on a few individual lives, because those numbers are just, they're beyond.
Absolutely. And I do want to talk about some of the individuals, but also, and this is just so horrifying, there was a failed revolution. I think it was 1591. And the townspeople, I guess, that rose up really paid this ultimate price and were sent to Siberia along with a bell. Help us understand what happened.
They had to drag the town bell from a town in western Russia into Siberia as punishment. And I found it a very evocative scene, because the tongue from the bell was torn out by the Tsar as just another punishment. So no music, no sound of music. It was a mute bell. Can you imagine this great big thing being dragged across the mountains, just as another extra layer of punishment. So I found it a very symbolic story when I was trying to write about music in Siberia.
And do you feel that suffering when you're in Siberia, this history of suffering? Do you feel it?
Yeah, you do. Yeah, it's deeply textured. It's in the conscience of those who live there now. It's in their history. It's in their families. It's hard to pull out those stories. There's still fear talking about them from the Soviet Gulag period. But this idea of how to say it was, Solzhenitsyn said it best, I think, is, can a man who's warm understand one who's freezing? And that it was a real challenge to, I had to go there. I went into the Gulag areas. I spent some time up in Kolymar, which is the sort of, again, what Solzhenitsyn called the worst of the worst, up in the far northeast of the region. And yeah, I mean, you feel it. It's in the bones of the place. But there is also, you know, there are other stories to tell.
Sure.
But I
sure.
certainly don't avoid it. I certainly don't avoid it. I go in deep and acknowledge it. But when I eventually turn my back on it, it's not without being profoundly affected by the stories I heard.
Indeed, and these are really just searing stories. You write about a woman named Vera Lotar-Shevchenko, who I guess was sent to a gulag along with her husband. Tell us about her.
Vera was wonderful. Lots of mixed reports of her character, but she was she had a real optimism in her soul. She was French born. She was a significant pianist, so much so that Le Figaro, the French newspaper, celebrated her in the 1920. She had this wonderful kind of velvet playing style. Her second husband was a Russian engineer who ended up being sent to a gulag. And when Vera went to protest his innocence, she too was arrested for what they used to call anti-Soviet agitation and propaganda. She was sent to a different labor camp. Now, her husband did not survive the gulag. She did. And on her release, I think it was in 1950, the first thing she did was walk out onto the streets of a local town to find a music school. She was still wearing her convict's quilted pea coat. And she asked that music school if she could play their piano. They said, of course. And they stood with the door half ajar, listening to this woman play maybe 1, 2, 5 hours of playing. There's different recounts of it. Note perfect. And what we were to learn is that she had, during her incarceration, played on a piano which her friends had carved into the side of her wooden bunk. And so she'd survived through the music in her head. It was just extraordinary. Anyway, I found her last piano where she eventually settled in Siberia. It was a moving story.
And was it one of those sort of simple Soviet pianos or something more elaborate than that?
No, it was a really special piano in the city called Akademgorodok, which is like Siberia's Silicon Valley. The kind of, they call it the little town with probably the biggest IQ anywhere. And some academics in that city, when it was still a Soviet city, they took her under her wing, and one of them gave her a Mühlbach grand piano, a very good one actually. Oh. And I tracked it down, and one of her last the instrument's last tuners, and her grave in this town, which I had cleared of, you know, deep 2 meters of snow. I went in January, and her gravestone reads, "Life in which there is Bach is blessed." It's just
oh my goodness, I'm welling up. And just to underscore what you're saying, so when she was in the gulag, obviously did not have access to a piano. Her fellow prisoners sort of carved a piano on her bed for her, or I guess her bunk for her. So while she played it, there were no notes to hear.
No notes. But that is something maybe we are experiencing in our different ways in lockdown. You have to make your own creativity. You have to find your own solace. And her example is extreme, but it's not unusual. I came across a boy who couldn't afford a piano in the Altai Mountains, and his parents had painted it onto a desk, the keyboard.
So that he could do the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would think, especially, and even from the pictures, so in fact, we posted a video on our Facebook site, the Lost Pianos of Siberia.com. There are a couple of videos there. We posted one, and you can just sort of see how forbidding in many ways Siberia is. But even some of these villages and cities, I mean, they look kind of rough and tumble. It looks like it's poor. Is it poor?
Yeah, in some places, yeah, very. But it's they're strong communities, and they look after each other, and they're tough people. You know, they're not overwhelmed or intimidated by the climate. Yeah, it is poor, but there's the community is rich. And something that I really came away with is that feeling of how this is a good way of explaining it. When the exiles first arrived into Siberia in the 19th century, they were called convicts by the Europeans on the European side of the Urals, but they were called unfortunates in Siberia. And other people would leave bread and water on the windowsills so that the convicts who were walking there in chains would be able to grab something to eat. And that deep sense of empathy and hospitality still exists, I think, in the Siberian communities that I encountered. Yes, very poor. Yes, sometimes not enough money to buy firewood. Yes, they can look really, really bleak, especially when that romantic layer of snow is removed in the autumn melt. But are they rich communities that look after each other? Yeah, absolutely.
And is that just because they're alone in this remote part of the world with such sort of difficult living conditions because of the weather?
I think so. I think that, you know, if there's large distances between you, you have to look after each other. I mean, it's not without its problems. You know, alcoholism is huge. There are lots and lots of issues. You see them in the cities, of course. But there is this feeling there is this feeling that people have time for you. And as a writer, that is magical. Can you imagine? I'm turning up in this place, English journalist, knocking on the door saying, have you got a piano? It's just weird. But there, they were like, if someone did that to me here in England, I'd be like, I just need to look at my diary. Maybe in 2 weeks, let's maybe set an appointment after I've checked you out. But there, not at all. The door would open and I was unleashed into what, you know, Russia is known as the land of endless talk. And that very neutral question, have you a piano, would just open up the hearts of people. And I would stay for days and eat with their families, share the mushrooms that they picked from the forest and share stories. So as you can tell, I kind of fell for Siberians, not to take away the horror of its past,
sure,
or the difficulties of modern living.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you. Sophie Roberts is our guest on Radio Times today. She's got a new book. It's called The Lost Pianos of Siberia. She went to Siberia to look for a piano for a gifted musician, pianist, actually living in Mongolia. But her quest took her to many different parts of Siberia. She met a lot of people and she learned a lot of history. And that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Here's an email from Rosanna. Says, I'm curious to learn more about her partnership with the photographer Michael Turek. I've heard that he made his own book, Siberia, and was wondering how the two books relate to each other. Sophie?
Michael is a very dear friend and collaborator. He's a fine art photographer, American, and he joined me on my first trip and most of the trips I took thereafter and recorded it. He shoots on film and he also recorded it on motion. He's making a documentary piece at the moment. And there was something about it that I liked because he shoots in this sort of, you know, heavy camera that makes a noise and it's got a sort of drama to it. And these wonderful portraits that he produced of some of the characters in the book, they stand there proudly with this instrument that maybe doesn't sound too great, but it carries the story of their life, and they are proud that it is still with them. And so it was great working with Michael, and he did indeed publish his own monograph by the Italian publishing house Damiani, but it's a fine art book. It's different from mine. Mine's a sort of, you know, non-fiction book. It's slightly different, but we work together all the time.
I assume you had a translator?
Yeah, I had an interpreter, and I'm used to working them, obviously, as a journalist, but it took some time trying to find the right one because it was going to be a long project and in difficult places and, you know, a lot of the time very uncomfortable. And I eventually found someone through desperation. I'd been in New York working, and I had failed with two interpreters prior to that who just weren't quite getting what I was after. Mm. And I ended up emailing someone who I could tell spoke good English. And I said to this person, I said, I need to find a four-wheel drive to take me through the Altai Mountains in January. Somebody who's tough enough to get me out of trouble, who can work with me for 4 weeks looking for a piano. Again, it sounded a little peculiar. And she wrote back and said, give me 10 minutes. And then she called me and she goes, I found someone. I said, who? And she said, me. And that was Elena Voitenko. And she stayed with me the whole way. I owe a lot to her.
Well, indeed. You do describe, talking about trouble. At one point, it seemed as if the authorities were suspicious of you, maybe even thinking you were a British spy, interrogated you. What happened?
Well, I was in the wrong place. I had the wrong paperwork. I was in a border area. You know, I was entirely to blame through my own naivety rather through anything else. But it was a wake-up call about how we encounter each other. It felt like stepping into a kind of, you know, a James Bond movie where I was MI6 and they were the Russian baddie. And we were both kind of approaching each other through that lens. But, you know, at the end of the day, it was okay. It was frightening when it happened, but I got through it, and I I've tried to make sure it hasn't coloured my the better side of Siberia and Russia that I experienced. But, it was odd. I was in these places where I wouldn't see anyone for weeks, where they just didn't see travellers, even in if it was a peak travelling season. And there I was saying, I'm looking for a piano. It just all sounded a bit odd. So I can see why I kind of raised eyebrows here and there. But generally, people were really helpful. You know, the Russian media were really helpful. I did various local radio pieces to try and track down stories around instruments. They couldn't have been more brilliant. You win some, you lose some.
I'm curious, as a travel writer, especially going to remote parts of the world, and you arrive in a place or you land in a place, how do you sort of figure out where you want to go or who you want to talk to? How do you sort of read what a place has that you want to find out about?
Well, the most important thing, and I've learned this over time, is you need time to do it. And I got into a habit with my magazine journalism of kind of parachuting in, of traveling. Travel had become like an act of consumption almost. And this is all pre-pandemic. You know, everything was about where to stay, where to eat. It was about the holiday culture. And we'd moved away from travel as an act of empathy, about understanding people and place in a way which just takes time and space. So I do try and give myself time and space to find the right person and to, you know, because one thing leads to another, leads to another, sure, leads to another. So I'm kind of old-fashioned like that as a reporter. I'm interested in the stories that you don't find on Google. You have to get out there and put your feet on the ground. And that's where I think travel writing can still survive in a world of social media and everything Instagrammed all over the place. And I think it still has life if we keep our boots on the ground and we remember that human stories are the ones that we remember rather than just place and the picturesque.
But do you feel your wings have been clipped because of the pandemic? I mean, I'm not a traveler like you, but I love to travel and I'm missing it so much.
Yeah, it's really, really hard. It's hard on two levels. One is really personal because I'm a restless person. And I think I was reading this the other day. Never in the history of the world, including the Second World War, has there been such a profound lack of movement. And that restlessness is atmospheric. It's also personal. It's a very, very strange feeling. So I started at the beginning of the pandemic thinking maybe I can work with that idea about restlessness. So I was leaning into a story about Dylan Thomas, who felt the same thing in the 1930s. People felt very restless in the 1930s. It was between two very big moments in history. And so I've been looking at all the writing that came out then and sort of digging into how other people have tackled times like this. And I spent some time in Donegal in Ireland, where Dylan Thomas went in 1935 to try and shake off this feeling of restlessness, to be still in a place that might give him comfort, right on the edge of Ireland. It's an amazing, amazing spot. And so I spent some time in a cottage there, very close to where he holed up. Didn't really help me. It didn't really help. It's difficult. But the other side of it, that's a very personal thing. The other side of it, it is heartbreaking to see the travel industry fall apart.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's do another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation again. Sophie Roberts is our guest. We're talking about travel, Siberia, and pianos. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Let me just recap what we're talking about. Siberia's landscape has long been defined by its extreme weather, its vast and diverse geography, also as a place of exile where prisoners and dissidents were sent under Russian czars and Soviet dictators. Our guest, travel writer Sophie Roberts, traveled the region looking for a piano for a gifted young musician. We're talking about her new book. It's called The Lost Pianos of Siberia. It's about her quest and about Siberia's unique culture and history, where suffering and survival can go hand in hand, where pianos are everywhere, where there is a rich culture of music and art. She used to write about luxury hotels for Condé Nast, if you can believe it, and now she writes about remote travel. And you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. So you've written about, or maybe even interviewed about, the fact that as a young girl, your family used to take vacations, I guess it was in Ireland, and these were, you know, not the vacations where everything is all planned out. It sounded very sort of loose and free. Can you describe some of those early travel experiences?
Yeah, I mean, my whole childhood was pretty loose and free. I was brought up on a farm in Scotland, and my holidays were on empty beaches, in those wild Scottish beaches, where my mother rather wonderfully would always say to us, oh, stop complaining about the weather. And her phrase was, it's warm rain. And that warm rain traveled with us to Ireland. We spent holidays in Donegal. And, you know, looking back on it through the sort of, you know, rosy window of nostalgia, it was a very happy way to travel, because it wasn't, it was free. It was free in time and space. And that's a wonderful way for kids to occupy themselves and find their own fun. But it wasn't until I was 18 that I traveled further afield, and when I went off to India for a year, and that's when I really got the bug for feet on the ground and being in the thick of it. I loved it.
I'm having a hard time imagining you writing about luxury hotels just based on our conversation so far.
Well, I needed to get a job. And Condé Nast Traveler, a glossy travel magazine, had just launched in the UK when I needed to get a job. And I was their first tea maker. And I made tea quite well for 2 years.
Really?
Yeah, I was quite good at making tea. And then I left. But I had learned in those 2 years lots of things from some really brilliant editors and journalists. And so I went off and freelanced. And the first freelance work I could get was doing the kind of nuts and bolts of travel journalism, which is hotel reviewing. So that's how I kind of entered this space. And I'm really grateful for it. You know, I'm really lucky to have gone through that period. But it was never my soul or my spirit, if that makes sense.
Well, yeah, there was such a job as a tea maker at Condé Nast.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I mean, I did other things like attend PR events. But, yeah.
Okay, I didn't know how full time that was. Well, I'm assuming.
No, I was a junior editorial assistant, you know. But
okay.
It was. I learned. I was an apprentice, like we all need to be, you know.
Do you, when you travel with your children, do you do the kind of trips you did as a kid yourself?
So any spare money I ever have, I take my children with me, and they are big travelers. I've taken my younger son to Papua New Guinea when he was 7, and my older son has, we spent lots of time in Bhutan, Nepal. They came to Siberia with me for 3 weeks.
Wow.
Which was very funny, because they didn't want to go back.
They did not want to go back to Siberia.
Back. No, we did some hiking for a few days and camping on the shores of Lake Baikal, which they loved. But then I had to do a little bit of piano archive work, and that was not interesting to an 8-year-old and an 11-year-old boy. So, yeah, Siberia, they've had enough of. But the hiking on Lake Baikal was incredible.
Wow. Wow. Well, I'm thinking about all those pianos. I'm thinking about the extreme weather of Siberia and the kind of battering that these pianos must take. Who preserves them? Who takes care of them? Piano tuners, I'm assuming?
Well, they were the keys to the kingdom. There was a wonderful gentleman that I met in effectively the capital of Siberia, Novosibirsk, who was the head of the Siberian Piano Tuners Association. And he kind of opened up this kind of kingdom of tuners who work all across the region looking after instruments that really have seen better days, that, you know, really are almost unsalvageable. But I was interested in a piano not just for the music that it made or could make with repairs. I was interested in the stories that were held in the object. There was some of your listeners may have read Edmond Duval's book, The Hair with Amber Eyes, an exquisite book, one of my favourites of all time, when he says, objects have always been carried, sold, bartered, stolen, retrieved and lost. People have always given gifts. It's how you tell their stories that matters. And that completely unleashed my potential to tell a story and the story of Siberia through an object, through a piano. So it wasn't always about the sound it made. It was about the story it held in its strings.
Well, in fact, and this is quoting from your book, each piano sings differently because of the people who played it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm very upfront in the book. I'm not a musician. I'm not a Russian speaker, but I am curious. And I hope I found empathy with these people that were very proud of these instruments, and for good reason, because they had survived against all odds, because somebody was taking care, because it mattered to somebody that that instrument prevailed. And that, I think, is a pretty powerful idea in a culture that I live in, which is so throwaway.
Well, and I don't think it's giving too much away because we're going to play Agarel Semple Norov, the young woman whose piano you were searching for, a new piano you were searching for. But I want to get back to her story. Now, she lived in Mongolia, and her family had, fled Siberia? What took them to Mongolia?
Well, there are many indigenous groups in Siberia and in that region before modern borders existed. And one of those groups around the shores of Lake Baikal are called the Buryat people. And Ogdarel is of Buryat descent. And now in the 1930s, the Buryat people, including members of Ogdarel's family, were persecuted under Stalin. That was when nomadic pastoralism was replaced with the collective herds. You know, the Buddhist religion was heavily suppressed, monasteries closed, the intelligentsia killed. And that Buryat homeland, which they defended in a rebellion in 29, I think it was, it saw some 35,000 Buryats killed. That was cut up into smaller territories. It effectively was disempowered. And she is of Buryat descent. So that border area, like any border area, carries stories from both sides. So I was always interested that she had that Siberian connection.
And how did she, and when did she start playing piano?
Oh, when she was small, very small. She really, really wanted to be a dancer, but somebody, thank goodness, recognized her talent with the piano. And then a group of people, including my friend who I was staying with that very first time I heard her play, sponsored her to train in Italy. And she spent 9 years in a conservatory in Perugia and returned to Mongolia, where she feels very strongly that that's where she belongs. And she wants to teach and perform. And she, the sort of magic of her work is that she combines the piano, which is this, its traditions belong to Europe, with the sound of the Morin Kerr, which is the horsehead fiddle, which is the sound of the steppe, the indigenous instrument of the steppe. And on the book's website, lostpianosofsiberia.com, you can hear these two instruments together. We made a recording just before COVID of these two instruments together. How I wish this pandemic wasn't upon us, because our intention was to do some recitals together. This whole project was a collaboration. Michael Tourette, the photographer, the musicians, the Morin Kerr player, everybody. It was meant to always be bigger than just my book.
I listened to some of that music, and it has, a lovely kind of dissonance.
It's haunting.
To my American ears.
I love it. It's, you know, each their own, but I love it. To me, it sounds like the horses galloping over the steppe. It sounds like you're in a fenceless landscape. It sounds like a different, it doesn't sound like it's been made for a kind of a drawing room in a Jane Austen novel. It's a different sound.
This is sort of a weird question, but what can the Siberian people teach us about the pandemic and about isolation, closeness, connection, culture?
About the pandemic, little. I think we're all in a bad way, and Siberia is having a bad time with it. But about how to survive lockdown, we have got used to, certainly I have got used to, so much seeking so much stimulation from outside myself. And actually, through literature, through reading, through music, either listening or playing, or through mastering an art, which is a really solitary experience, there is great solace and comfort. And that was certainly a takeaway that I took. And also that enough is enough. We don't need all that we think we might need. They live pretty simply, and they make things last, and they don't throw away like my culture does. And yeah. I think that's something that we've all realized with this pandemic and with this, you know, the parallel experience of desperate climate change, which is affecting Siberia even more than most places, that we have to all take a step back. And that's what I took away. But
well, and I had a question about climate change and how climate change is affecting Siberia. And I'm assuming, like a lot of these very extreme northern climates, you've got rising temperatures.
Yeah, I mean, you feel it. There was one time when I was up there, I was traveling on the Trans-Siberian train, and it was the time I was with my children, and the smoke from the forest fires was tumbling into Mongolia. It was affecting Ulaanbaatar. Then we went up to Lake Baikal into the city of Irkutsk, and it was thick, you know, so it was very tangible. You could feel it on your lungs. Then in the far north, where I spent some time in the Russian Arctic with the indigenous group of people called the Nenets, they rely upon a stable climate in order to work with their reindeer herds. And that is just going, you know, you're getting the tundra is melting. And when the tundra melts, it's a bog. It's not a landscape that you can travel over. So it's pretty brutal. It's pretty brutal. But equally, they feel it first because it's an extreme climate, just like Australia.
A caller is asking about, I'm not sure I'm going to pronounce the name of the city correctly, but it's on the edge of Siberia, where Tsar Nicholas II and his family were executed. Just curious whether you had visited there.
Yes, I did. And in fact, one of the more difficult parts of my reporting was to try and find the last Tsar's piano, because we know from records that the family had one, the daughters and the empress had one in their house of the final house they lived in when they were under house arrest before their eventual murder. And it was a tough story to dig into, but yeah, I did spend time in that city, Ekaterinburg.
We're going to close things out with Agdarel Semple-Norov, and she's going to be playing John Field's Nocturne No. 4. This is on a Groschen Steinweg piano. Can I assume that this is the piano that you found in your quest?
Oh, I'm not going to say, Marty. I've got
so
to get
sorry.
People to read to the end of the book. but it's certainly her playing a very, very beautiful piano.
And without, I don't want to give, you know, too much away, but are there pianos still everywhere around Siberia, or are they becoming an endangered species?
Oh, an endangered species, but if you go looking, you'll find them in museums. And I got excited when I found them not in museums, but in a wooden cottage in a small village. You know, there was one Bechstein I found literally that had been sold for the price of a bag of potatoes during the Second World War. That was when it got exciting. These kind of relic instruments that were treasured in places you just don't expect to find them. Yeah, they're there.
Sophie Roberts, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And her book is called The Lost Pianos of Siberia. And again, you can go to the lostpianosofsiberia.com. There is more music there and some videos as well and more information about Sophie Roberts and her adventures in Siberia. And this is John Field, Nocturne No. 4, performed by Otgarel Sempelnorov on a Croatian Steinweg piano. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Henson. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.